My name is Alba Calvino Klein. I'm going to talk about Iron Mountain a long time ago when I was a very young girl. I had the advantage of parents who came from Europe. My father, Valerio Calvino, was born in Italy. My mother, Anna Sandretto Calvino, was born in France, but of Italian parentage. They were married in Mannheim, Germany. They had children in Luxembourg and in France, but they also lived in Switzerland, Germany, and Belgium. World War I was coming along. My father didn't want to go to war because he didn't believe in some of the things that they were fighting for in Europe at that time. So he went to South America for a while, seeking freedom, which was not on the landscape in Europe. My mother waited for him and listened to his letters. She saw he was very unhappy. So she wrote to him in Argentina, "Meet me in Iron Mountain, Michigan, where I have some sisters." So she took my brother, Calvin, and my sister, Idea, crossed the ocean and went through Ellis Island and came to Iron Mountain, where her sisters were. My father, in the meantime, worked his way up from Buenos Aires up the coast to Rio de Janeiro, took a Portuguese ship, came through Ellis Island, and came to Iron Mountain. And I was born in Iron Mountain in 1915. Their only American child. I had the background of the fact that my parents talked 5 foreign languages, so I learned 3 before I went to school, English, French, and Italian. My parents always believed that if you went to a country, you should never live among your own people, and which would be Italian, because you cannot learn the language well. So they lived down on Ludington Street. That was the west side of Iron Mountain, and the people around them were Polish and English. My father had built a house for my mother. You see, he was a mason, and his job was building houses, churches, buildings for people. In Europe, he used to work 16 hours a day at 10 cents an hour, $1.60 a day. How would you like wages like that? So when he came to America hoping to make a better life for his family, so he built the house out of bricks down on Ludington Street. And you must remember, I was born in that house. In those days, children were not born in hospitals as they were in this day and age. The house had 2 stories. It was heated by a coal stove. The kitchen stove had a wood stove. And I always remembered it. We always had hot water because by the side of that wood stove, there was a reservoir. My mother filled it from water. And there wasn't any water at the faucet as we have it again. She had to go outside, prime the pump, and pump it by hand, carried by a pail into the house and put it in the reservoir, which was part of the stove. Then the wood stove would heat up the water. But we were very lucky because on the bottom of that reservoir was a faucet, and I thought that was wonderful. All you had to do was turn the faucet handle, and there you had hot water, almost like this modern day and age. For bathrooms, well, we had the outside toilet, and my mother kept it clean. She used to take live water. I never could understand how she could put her hands in that lye water to wash things so sparkling and clean that they were almost white. But every Saturday night she had a tin tub, and she would bring in the tin tub and have the heated hot water, carry water outside from the pump, and everybody had their Saturday baths. So you see, even though things were rather rugged, we could still be clean. That house there in Ludington had 5 acres. So my mother had come from a farming community in Italy, so we had a cow. She also had a pig, she had chickens, and she had some ducks in a pond. And on this day and age in Iron Mountain, that would be against the law. You can't have animals like that in the premises. But in those days, everybody seemed to have their own private milk factory, because we used to see with the cow we had milk, and had our own private egg factory. And once in a while, my mother would sell some eggs, and also our own private chicken factory, which is very unusual in these times. That is the sort of community in which I grew up. There was a lot of, because we were on the west side, there weren't that many houses, so there was lots of land for me to roam as a little girl. I can always remember my mother would go shopping uptown. We would walk uptown, and of course in the beginning years, her English was not that good, so if she couldn't make herself understood in English, she would use the French or the Italian, and somebody would understand her. She never had an interpreter because she was determined that she was going to do her own business by herself. This is the background from which I came. on Saturday nights, that was rough times in a place called Hewitt Street in Iron Mountain. You see, around Iron Mountain, there was a logging community and also many mines. So Saturday night, when the miners were paid and the loggers were paid, you can imagine where they would go for the taverns to have their beer. Well, my mother would come up the street, and she'd had an old tin bucket. She would get that full of beer, and she would take that home for my father. But many times, there might be a fight on Saturday nights between the loggers and the miners. And I can remember holding on to my mother's skirts, sometimes crying, wondering why all those people were beating each other around them, because that was hot, a hot and heavy time in Iron Mountain. So the things went along. As I said, I was born in 15, but the World War I was happening in Europe. So America went into the war about the year 1918. I believe the day was April 6th, and it was through on November 11th, 1919. Again, it was wartime as in Iron Mountain, as was for all communities. But just about that time, about 1919, we went to Iron River for a period of about 6 years. And again, we have to think back of the conditions of the times. My father, again, I said, was building property. There wasn't that much building in Iron Mountain, but there was lots of building going on in Iron River. And for that reason, he went to Iron River, because you see, cars were not that plentiful. You either had to go by train in those days, or if you had a horse, or if you could hop a ride with somebody, because cars were just beginning to come along for the smaller people. So in Iron River, we had our first car. That was 1919. My young brother learned how to drive it. We always thought that was a thrill when those old touring models open, and it was very, very cool. But then, all of a sudden, business started to pick up in Iron Mountain again. The Ford Motor Company decided that Iron Mountain was a great place to establish a factory. As I mentioned, the Ford Motor Company came to Iron Mountain in the 20s. The reason Ford picked Iron Mountain for such a venture was the fact that there are lots of wood around here, and of course there were the mines. So, and also there was the labor market. Coming into America were the different various ethnic groups. When we came back to Iron Mountain the second time, we moved to a home that my father built again on the 200 block of West D Street. Again, my parents did not pick the north side of Iron Mountain. The Italians lived on the north side, but my mother felt again, to perfect yourself in a language, you should always live among the people of the country. And where we were on D Street, the English people lived. We were completely surrounded by English people. And these English people came from Wales. Right next to us was a man who had been working in the mines in England. And when he came here, he became a mining captain. Across the street again was another mining captain. So you see, we were surrounded by this mining element. The mines were very profitable at the time because the iron ore was very good. As I said, we lived in this what was called the West Side, where the English people were. There was also the French people. The town began to be divided. They began to live in localities. Most of the Italians lived in the North Side. The Swedish people lived in what was called the Hill. That would be the East Side of Iron Mountain. So again, we had an element of racism that was growing up. The young people had a hard time going with each other. I can remember the fact that my brother had a girlfriend who was Swedish, and my mother would say to him, "Oh no, that's not the girl for you. You should have an Italian girl." And of course, her mother would say to the girl, "You should not have an Italian boyfriend. You must have a Swedish boyfriend." You see, they wanted their children to find companionship within their own race. They forgot that America was a melting pot. And so we had racism again on Saturday nights. There were the fights between the groups. Fights between the Swedish and the Italians, or the Swedish people and the English people. And they were really brawls, beating each other. But again, as I say, the labor market was here. So Ford was glad to establish the factory. It has been said that at one time, Ford had 7,000 men working for him in this factory. When you think of that many people, way back in the 20s, it has been said that our population in Iron Mountain alone was 20,000 compared to our 8,000 at the present time. Well, the situation was so bad. Can you imagine people living in chicken shacks? That's exactly what happened in the 20s. There was no place to live. There were not enough homes. So garages were converted into homes. where people had chickens. Those were converted to homes. I remember visiting people which had, the home had been a former chicken shack, believe it or not. So you can imagine the smell. So they, any place they could find, they would use it for homes. Well, people did not, still did not have tolerance for each other. It will take a longer time than that to have tolerance. You can imagine the community. I was growing up, I was in the grades in Iron Mountain at that time. The schools, there were quite a few schools. There were more schools in Iron Mountain at that time than there are now. There was a school that was way up what we call the 25 edition. Why they call it 25 edition or 25 location, it was because there was a mine up there and they called it the 25 mine. There was a school up there which is no longer existing. There was the central school, which was a wooden building downtown. There was the high school, which my father had helped build in 1911, which was supposed to be an improvement. There was the Lincoln School, which no longer exists. There's also the Washington School, and that no longer exists. And we had the Hull School, which was the 7th and 8th grade school way up on the hill. It looked like a castle, and that no longer exists. So the school, there were more schools almost in those days than we have in the present time. Well, the enrollment was quite large, again, because of the population of the town. The schooling was very, very good, though, I would say, because I always considered myself to have a good education as far as Iron Mountain was concerned. But, again, every ethnic group, because of the fact there were so many mines, and then there was Fords, they needed to have more people here. I can remember my mother writing back to Italy, and she helped to get her brothers and some cousins over here. And the brothers who came, one brother worked in the mine, and the other brother worked with my father as a mason, building buildings that had to be built. The other cousins worked in the mine. That was happening with most of the families. The people came over here, they had jobs. There was lots of work to do. Salaries weren't very high, but it was from the year 1920 after World War I, until about 1929, just before the crash. Those were called the boom and bust years all over America. Conditions are very good, but people were buying so much on credit, which was typical of Iron Mountain, that everyone thought this is never going to end. It's going to be great forever. So actually, as far as want in those years, people were not in want in Iron Mountain. Maybe want for a house, but they found some housing. I said, even if it was a chicken shack or a garage. But eventually, as the workers came, new houses were being built all along the way. And then people just crowded together. Because I can remember in our house, a two-story house, we had 14 people living in it. And that was a lot of people. My mother would get up 5 o'clock in the morning, and she would get the buckets ready for the miners to go to the mine, because we had other people staying there besides the relatives. And my sister and I worked very hard as young girls, helping my mother, either doing the baking or making the beds or ironing clothes for her. And I think this is typical of the life of most of the people those days. Even the young found some work somewhere. Of course, wages were very low. I can remember washing a car for 25 cents. Doesn't sound very much in this day and age, but it seemed a lot at that particular time. But all of a sudden, in 1929, we had the crash. Well, a lot of most of the people were very, had been thrifty. My parents were, because they had been very, very poor. My father, when he came here, knowing the bad conditions in Europe, he had been a labor organizer. So he helped to organize the American Federation of Labor Bricklayers Union. In fact, he was a member of that union for over 50 years in order to improve the lot of the working man, because wages were beginning to get better. But with the crash, everything fell apart. My father and my mother, and I'm sure this would happen to a lot of people, their money was frozen in the banks, because with the crash, remember, they had the bank moratorium. So people could not get their money out. So my high school years were not that great, for the simple reason that the depression came along. And the conditions were hard for everyone. I can remember during high school years, when we were juniors, we were supposed to go out and sell magazines. Who could sell a magazine? Anybody those days. No, people weren't working. My father hadn't worked for 2 years at that time. And when it came to the senior year, we wanted to have an organize. We are the only class, the class of 1933 from the Iron Mountain High School, we are the only class that never had an Argonaut, which is a school annual, because we could not afford to have it. And we felt very resentful. So when it came to sign to sell the magazines, many of us took our magazine folders that we were supposed to use, and we took them and shredded them up like confetti and threw them all over the school lawn, because we were angry at what was handed to us. Because here we were graduating and no jobs. A lot of the boys went into what was called the CCCs, the Civilian Conservation Corps. In fact, you see, at that time, the schools would graduate in January and in June. But what was the sense of graduating in January? There was no work. So you might as well stay in school till June, and that extra half year of schooling, at least you had some place to stay at your folks, and so maybe some place to eat. Maybe you'd find a job here and a job there, hopefully even if it was just a few cents. So at graduation, I was able to get a job working as a secretary for the Wisconsin-Michigan Power Company. But to get the job, I'll have to tell you what happened. My sister, who had graduated in 1926, worked for the company. But when she married in 32, her husband had a job, and she had a job. Because the Depression was so bad in 33, the company said, "I'm sorry, it's government ruling. Only one person can work in the family." So my sister had to give up her job because her husband was working. And so when she gave up her job, I stepped into her job. That's how you got a job in those days. Somebody either died or you stepped into their jobs. Otherwise, you were out of luck. And of course, I was very glad to get the job because my father hadn't worked in two years. Now, to stay 2 years without working and have to live on your resources, trying to get a little bit at a time, maybe 10% at a time of your money in the bank, you know, that was bad. In fact, my mother never trusted banks after that. She used to take money and hide it all over the house. And when she got older, into her 80s, once we found $3,300 in the house because she had hid it, because no way again was she going to be in that position to have the banks fail on her and not to have any money, not even to buy food. So you can see what the Depression did to a lot of the people with their thinking. And it wasn't just my mother. There were many people. They instead of trusting the banks, they kept the money in the home. And of course, we know robbers will come along, so money isn't exactly that safe. Well, I have to tell you about the job when you talk about salaries, though, in 1933. I went to work for 15 cents an hour as a secretary. I had been valedictorian in my class, and I had wanted to go to college, 2 scholarships, but no way of earning board and room. That, and of a class of 145 students, only 5 of us went to college. No one else could afford to go. We had to find some work or do something else. My husband, but he wasn't my husband at the time, he went to work as a machinist for $9 a week for 6 days a week and sometimes 10 hours a day. What do you think of that for salaries for people of this day and age? So it was very, very rough times. And when they say that people did not starve, that was a lie of the Depression, because people did starve. I can remember that in those days we had lots of trains in our mountain, more than we have now. In fact, there aren't any trains now. You talk about as far as passenger trains, but there were many trains at that time. And we could see, because we were about 2 blocks from the trains, we could see coming down the tracks, we call the hobos. They would be riding the rides would be riding underneath the trains to go from one part of the country looking for jobs. They couldn't afford a ticket very well, so they would hitch a ride. Of course, it was against the law. And many times they could have an arm cut off or a foot cut off because it was very dangerous riding underneath the cars. But when they would come to our mountain, my mother always said, "I think they've got an X marked on our house," because they would come directly we could see them from far away. They would come directly to the house asking for food. And my mother and my father never turned them away. Whatever we had, we shared, because they remembered how it was to be hungry. And I think we weren't the only ones. I think there were all other people too. And again, when you're talking about this people out of work, so many in our mountain all over the country, relief, we didn't have welfare in those days. You either had to earn it or you didn't. You know, there was that expression, if your hands don't move, your mouth doesn't move. So you must know, if you don't work, you're not going to eat. So you have to do something. We pool resources. And we talk about these men, these hobos riding the rails. They would have their hobo jungles, and we could see them around different spots, some place where there'd be a little gully, so it would be protected. They would gather a little wood, and they would start a fire. They'd try to make themselves some coffee, cooking perhaps out of a tin can or something that had been thrown away, and they would share with each other. And that's the way their life was in those times. How does it feel to be young? It wasn't a very pleasant time, and yet looking back at it, maybe because we didn't have so much, we had to learn to get along with each other in that time. I can remember a group of our friends. Gasoline at that time was 25 cents a gallon. And it encouraged people to buy gasoline. Sometimes they would have specials of 5 gallons for a dollar. Plus the fact you'd get maybe some free glassware, maybe a glass, or maybe a dish, or maybe some silverware, because that was a gimmick they would have to have you buy gas at the different stations. That sounds so ridiculous compared to what we have to do in this day and age. But even at 25 cents a gallon, we who were very young, in order to do something, well, my brother loaned us his car. So the bunch of us, we'd pool our quarters to get gas for the car. That was the only way we could have any fun. Then we'd go on a picnic, because we could go many places and picnics were for free. And we used to say the best things in life are free. That was a song of those times around Iron Mountain, because it seems that you could do so much for less without spending a lot. And even when we went to the show, can you imagine going to a show for 25 cents? Sometimes you'd have a double feature. And some of our theaters in Iron Mountain at that time, we had one called the Bijou Theater. And Bijou in French means jewel. And of course, that was old theater. In fact, later when they abandoned it for a theater, it was used for a church for a while. When the Church of St. Joseph burnt down, which was about the year, I think around 1929 or 1930, somewhere around that time, the people used the Bijou Theater for a church on Sundays. So I can remember going there. In fact, I used to teach catechism in those days, and I can remember teaching the children there. Then there's also the Colonial Theater, and that was supposed to be the theater after the Bijou. And they always, and of course it was great. For a quarter, you'd see two shows, double features, not the days of TV. That was our TV at that particular time. Then later on, when they built the Bramart Theater, oh, we thought that was the greatest thing that could happen to Iron Mountain. So when they abandoned the Bijou, and we had the Colonial and the Bramart, and that was fairly good, two theaters in the town. So, but when boys and girls, or the young, used to go, they'd have to, most of the time, we'd go, it was called Dutch Treat. The girls would pay for their own, and the boys would pay for their own, because who had money in those days? Nobody had very much, so you shared what you had. But things start, again, some of our ethnic groups, some of them who did come here at the time, if they had a little money when conditions were so bad, those Depression years, they went back to Italy. And we saw that from not just Italy alone, we saw that from other groups. If they have a little money, they decided to go back home, and they did, because conditions were very bad. The mines were still running, but not very well. Finally, 1939 came along, and we saw the condition of the war. Things began to improve around Iron Mountain, too, because with war, well, there was more. The Ford Company started to manufacture parts of planes. The mines were going full blast. The lumbering was great, because this encouraged all during the wartime. So conditions started to get better in Iron Mountain with war. It's a shame that a war has to come along to better conditions of a community, but it did. And things started to go up, so we became got out of the Depression because of the war years. And this about this time in 1939 is when I was married, and I left Iron Mountain for about 25 years. So I suppose I should end it there until I came back later.
Mrs. Klein, would you tell us about the cessation of the mining operations, what brought it about, and also something about the Chapin Pit, which I understand resulted because of the Chapin Mine, which was sunk very near to it.
Well, I can remember living in Perkins, because I used to come home very often. My husband was district manager at that time in a district for the Wisconsin-Michigan Power Company. He held this job for over 30 years. The mines kept running for a bit. Little by little, mining kept going down. And one of the reasons mining was going down, the iron ore that was coming out of the mines was a low grade, and it was too expensive to mine. So little by little, the mines were going down as far as operation, that finally it was abandoned. I was trying to recall the year that, see, I came back to Iron Mountain in 62, but somewhere, perhaps in the early 50s, you might find it in the historical ledger there, when the mine was closed completely, it's been said that there's an underground river, but there's a lot of water down there. For a long time, the city began to pay for the pumping. There were pumps there that was pumping the water. A lot of the water that was pumped out of the mine was sent down to Crystal Lake into Mud Lake. And in fact, when I was a young girl, Crystal Lake was a beautiful lake for swimming. In fact, they had a bathhouse down there, and there were different things. I say it was a great area for swimming. It isn't as you see it today. So the water was being pumped down there, and besides, they also used the water for drinking water. But finally, they got to a condition, a place of time, that Iron Mountain decided it was too expensive to pump the water out of the Chapin Mine anymore. So we had going across what we call now the road going across Chapin Pit. On both sides of that road, there was a deep chasm, a gully, And in fact, it, shame to say it, it was a dumping pit. It was full of cans in those days. And I can remember the young kids sitting on the side of it with guns, and they used to shoot the rats off as they came out of there. So it was a completely dumping area, nothing else. Now, here we have the city deciding they are not going to run those water pumps anymore. So they quit the water pumps. When they quit the water pumps, the water from this underground source rose in the mine through all the levels. There were many levels in that mine. And after it filled the levels, here, after all, if you have a hole somewhere, the water is going to go. So it filled up that shapen pit. In fact, it has been said that pit is 90 feet deep. But finally, the road itself was not in very good condition. They should have repaired the road to see this coming, but they didn't. They didn't look forward enough. And all of a sudden, I said they didn't repair there. All of a sudden, one day, you'll have to check the date back somewhere in the historical record. The water undermined the road, and when some cars were going across, the road went down in there, and some people, they didn't lose their wife, but some of the cars went in. But the water in the pit was a direct result of the pumps not being shut down in the mine, so the water had to go somewhere. Now we have almost like two lakes there, which were in fact to replace the dumping ground that we had back in the 20s and 30s.
When did the city decide to clean up this area and get rid of all the things that were put into it?
The cans were never rid of. They're still there in the bottom. They never got rid of it. It's just the water rose and the cans are still in the bottom. As far as cleaning up the area was never cleaned up. See, the minute the pumps were closed, the water rose and it formed the two lakes. The only thing that was at fault, I think they should have watched as far as the repairing of the road. Then after the cars went in, then they repaired the road, and they're still keeping an eye on it because they are not sure whether that area will ever get undermined. In fact, it has been said that the Chapin Mine has undermined our mountain way as far as where I live in the 1000 block. They said that the whole area is undermined. We know the north side is undermined because for a good long time, every once in a while, any of the houses closest to the Chapin pit were sinking into the pit because of the fact that the area was undermined and there had been no way of shoring up the houses at all.
How deep were these mines?
As far as level, that I don't really know because it's something when I was very young. I forget how many levels that they had, that the miners. And by the way, when you talk about, which I could have mentioned before, when you go down into the mines, they didn't have the electricity and whatnot they have now. The miners would had hats, but on the hats they would have candles. The candles were lit, and of course they had to take their lunch down there. And many times before they went down the mines, they would put canaries down to make sure the air was all right, because they never were sure if things would be okay. And even the lifts that would go down, up and down, like we think of the elevators, they aren't like the modern elevators of this day and age. They were lifts mostly on pulleys that were going down into the mine, and they themselves were very, very dangerous. And then when the miners came out of the mine, they were so dirty with that iron ore rust. They did have a spot in an old mining house which exists today. It's an antique shop across the pit, and there they would use it where they could wash themselves off so they'd be a little clean before they came home, so they wouldn't carry that iron rust home with them. But if you think of they went down with candles, you can think of the fact how dark it must have been to spend dark and damp all that time in that mine, because there was that running water. And in fact, I would advise anybody, they would go down into the Vulcan Mine. Of course, we have to remember that Vulcan Mine that you visit, it's got electricity, which they didn't have much in those days. And that's really a little bit more modern, but it'll give you an idea what mining was like.
Do you recall many accidents in these mines?
You know, as far as the Chapin Mine itself, I really can't recall any accidents. Looking back at the one you do hear about, like you have that one that's close to Vulcan, where there were several people that were sealed in the mine. There that was their permanent tomb, that all of a sudden the mine caved in. But not as far as within the area itself of our mountain. I can't recall a very serious accident. You know, those days, though, they got what was called miners' consumption. It actually was a silicosis, I think that was the expression you'd use. In fact, my sister-in-law's father, who had been a mining captain, he was Swedish, by the way, and he was a mining captain in the mine for a long time. He died of that. So that was typical. It's one of the diseases that they had in those days, because you couldn't be that long time in the mine without going without something, either a severe case of rheumatism, because that dampness would hit you, or
in breath, and maybe have a seat by the eastern wall, and I discuss the holy books with the learned men 7 hours every day. That would be the sweetest thing of all. If I were a rich man, all day long I'd be bidi-bidi-bong. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. Lord, who made the lion and the lamb, you decreed I should be what I am. Would it spoil some vast eternal plan if I were a wealthy man? Champion, Mr. Andy Williams.
Whiter than Mars, I'm crossing you in style someday. Love somebody sometime. Everybody falls in love somehow.
When I'm calling you,
I will answer too.
Will answer to I will answer to
give the world to be. Among the folks in EIX, I even know my family. Waiting for me, praying for me down by this body. The folks of God will.
Welcome to my room. Won't you come on in? Miracles I get. Still have leave your cares behind. Welcome to my world.
Welcome to my world.
Filled with you in mind. Something in my heart told me I must have you.
Strangers in the night, two lonely people, we were strangers in the night. Up to the moment when we said our first hello, little did we know, love was just a
we've been together, lovers at first sight, in love forever, you turned out all right, for strangers in the night.
In the misty moonlight, by a flickering firelight,
everything's all right. In a faraway land, on the tropic sea sand, give your hands in mine. And when I look, the moon appears.
Hi, this is Johnny Carson. This Sunday evening, the National Academy of Television Arts and Sciences will announce the recipients of this year's Emmys. As host, may I invite you to join me and many of television's top performers as we...